We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Jeffrey Christian, Managing Partner of the CPM Group. How are you today, Jeff?
Good, Tom. It's great to be back with you.
Great to have you back and to have a bit more of your perspective here, let's say, on some more broad topics rather than just silver this time. So I would like to kind of start there and we can go out. We're going to talk about inflation and, you know, what's happening in the copper market, stuff like that. But I'd like to start with a recent presentation that you made at the Silver Symposium in September, and you had a discussion along with David Morgan. So for those that weren't there or haven't watched it yet, what are some of the main points that you disagree with David when it comes to the fiat or the financial system here?
I'm not sure where we exactly disagree, because I'm not quite sure where his views are. You know, I do have a broader contention, not necessarily against David or contrary to David, but just, you know, I use, when I hear people talk about fiat currencies, they get marked down in my book, simply because the concept of fiat currencies, that's like tuna fish. You know, all currencies are fiat, including gold standards. You know, the meaning of fiat means that it is a value that is arbitrarily arrived at. And in reality, the value of gold is arbitrarily arrived at. It's arbitrarily arrived at by millions of people bidding, you know, buying and selling gold. But, you know, people say, well, what should the gold price be? And they say, well, in 1999, 2000, 2001, it was $260. Last year it was 2000. Today it's 1770. Why? Well, in 1999, 2000, people thought that we were in a new economic paradigm, that inflation was gone, that recession was gone, and the stock market was going to go from 10 to 40,000 within months. You know, and so who needed gold? And we actually were doing studies from mining companies and others at the time about, well, what is the cataclysmic price of gold? You know, how low does gold fall if investors don't want gold? Not that they sell it, but, you know, okay. So you're $260. Then, you know, fast forward 20 years and it's $2,000. Why? Because people wanted gold and they had less faith in all those other assets and more faith in gold. So the value of gold is determined by fiat, the same way that the value of a paper currency issued by a national central bank is fiat. So I think that's one of the basic things is, you know, you have a lot of people who subscribe to what is called the Austrian School of Economics. Economists call it something else. They don't necessarily see it as a school of economics. But, you know, you have a lot of people who talk about the true value of gold and only gold is sustainable, is real money, and everything else is fiat currencies. And I don't necessarily spend a lot of time in that part of the world. I spend most of my time in the broader part of the world that sort of says, no, you know, this is the economic reality. This is the financial reality. This is how financial markets really work. And the idea of everything else is phony just doesn't factor in, you know. And I think David understands that, but he also has, I think, probably a belief. I shouldn't speak for him, you know, but I think he probably has a belief that, you know, all of this house of cards can fall, you know. And, you know, I was talking to somebody yesterday who said that, you know, he has a associate who is getting up in years and is waiting for $5,000 gold. And I said, you know, a lot of people have died waiting for $5,000 gold. It's just, I'm not one of them.
Mm-hmm. And as you recently pointed out, you know, you really have to make these distinctions. The example that came to mind was that when people talk about returning to a gold standard, you really have to, you know, say exactly what you mean by that. As you said, there was the example that most most gold standards only held a 40% gold reserve ratio, right?
Right. I mean, it was like, yeah, if you had to have gold equivalent to 40% of your currency in circulation in your reserves.
So you point to in your research reports, you visualize this through bubbles that show the markets that are good for gold in order of importance and timing as well. So what are some of these bubbles and how have they moved around since you've been presenting them, Jeff?
There are various factors. And one of the points that we've been making, because a lot of people are talking about inflation, and we don't see inflation as being particularly problematic at this point. But obviously, inflation is one. If we thought that inflation was going to be a bigger problem on a longer term basis, it would be up in there. You know, we have another graphic that we use, which is listing six broad topics. Mm-hmm. And we show them red, yellow, or green. And right now, inflation is one of them. Gold as a current as an inflation hedge, and it's yellow. You know, it's not that inflation isn't a problem, but it's also not flashing, hey, buy gold, in our view, because we're looking at it and we're seeing, you know, for example, the September data that came out this week, or late last week rather, on inflation showed, you know, that month to month, we've gone from 0.9% inflation to 0.4% inflation, which is almost back down to that 0.2, 0.3% inflation month to month that we were seeing before the pandemic. So, you know, I don't see inflation as an issue. Another one is portfolio diversifier. So we spend a lot of time looking at the stock market and the bond market. And the stock market and bond market are both highly overvalued. And we do think that there is scope for downward side. We're not of that group that says, oh, you know, the stock market is going to fall 50% or 80% or 90%. But, you know, we do think that the value is artificially driven by the fact that you have massive stock buybacks. You have a tremendous amount of money that is being poured into the stock market. And you have decapitalization, which is a long-term negative for the economy, but it's a short-term sugar high for the stock market. And the bond market, to some extent, is in the same place. So we're paying a lot of attention to looking at debt, the mounting debt, not only on the state and federal government levels, but on an international level among governments, corporations, and individuals. And we're looking at this excess money that's poured into the bond market and the stock market. And one of the areas that we're spending a lot of time looking at is not treasuries. I mean, everyone looks at treasuries. And quite frankly, treasuries are probably the least risky area of the debt market. So we're looking at private sector debt, corporate debt. We're looking at those dark corners that no one pays attention to in the debt market, you know, like the CMOs. We spent a lot of time during the last crisis trying to explain what a collateralized mortgage obligation was to people who didn't know, and in some cases had them in their portfolios. Okay, so stocks, bonds, inflation, currency volatility, central bank buying trends, overall federal spending, the breakdown in governance and the political system in the United States domestically, but also in other countries domestically, including China, you know, and the UK and parts of Europe. You have problems domestically, politically, all over the world. And then you have international political issues where you've seen a breakdown in cooperation and an increased amount of saber rattling and a lot of espionage and a lot of misinformation being planted. So, you know, this past week we had the whole thing actually from August about the spacecraft that the Chinese launched, and the U.S. government told the BBC that it was actually a hypersonic missile. Now, just because you need to find reasons to support massive defense spending. And, you know, Chinese people going to space doesn't necessarily justify $700 billion of defense spending, but a hypersonic missile would. Now, so you've got a lot of really bad things going on politically, economically, financial market instability, divisions within societies. And those are all those factors. Those are those bubbles that are getting bigger. And, you know, they were not particularly imminently dangerous 18 months ago. And then they got really imminently dangerous 12 months ago, and they've backed off a little bit now. So you've got some breathing space, we think, before they become much more immediate of concern.
You brought up the basically the way that you saw the mortgage crisis developing. And in your Silver Symposium talk, you were saying that in 2004 to 2005, you had several indicators of that coming crash in real estate prices, one being real estate investors that were selling and buying metals. So do you have any signs like that that you're seeing right now?
Yeah. What I was saying was, back in 2004, 2005, real estate prices were just becoming unsupportable. And frankly, I think real estate prices are always unsupportable. As an economist, you look at the average income of households and you look at the average price of housing and you say, who can afford this housing? And yet we do. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, hey, living in New York, you should know this better than anybody else. No one can afford to live in New York, but we all do somehow. But in 2004, 2005, you saw professional investors in real estate saying, I just can't justify buying more real estate. And then it got worse and it got worse. And they said, well, if I can't justify buying it, I probably can't justify holding on to it. So, we had several centimillionaires and billionaire clients who were liquidating their real estate portfolios and putting their money into gold and silver. We don't get involved in real estate, but all of a sudden we have these people that we don't know buying gold and silver. And that was a big sign that there was something going wrong in the real estate market. We're seeing a little bit of that now. We haven't seen as much of it as we saw in, say, 2006, 2007. But there is a little bit of that shaking around where professional real estate investors are saying, these prices probably are at the level where I should not continue buying, and B, probably should start liquidating some of my positions because it doesn't seem quite tenable.
So when we think about bubbles like that, Jeff, do you ever see, let's say, people that have made a lot of money in cryptos come over to gold and silver?
There is some of that. What we mostly see are people who are long-term investors or short to long-term investors in... They're investors in gold and silver, and they are speculators or gamblers in cryptos. So we have clients who, will take short-term and long-term positions in precious metals assets, including equities, but also bullion and options and index notes and things like that. But they will play on a day basis in cryptos. And, 2 years ago, they would go home flat in cryptos because it was just like a slot machine for them. But now they will take longer term positions. But there's this view that at some point that house of cards is going to fall and they think they can be the first one out the door.
So, Jeff, you recently spoke about how gold prices don't correlate well with inflation. So why is this belief, still out there? And what types of inflation does gold do a good job of accounting for?
Yeah. It's funny because Roy Jastrom in his book, The Golden Constant, that was his conclusion. He said, gold does really well in protecting you against catastrophic inflation, really high inflation. And we saw that in the 1970s at a time when you didn't have a lot of other inflation hedge investments, So gold and silver were the inflation hedge investments. And when you had inflation of 7%, 10%, and then 14%, gold and silver did very well because investors were moving their assets into them. And that is true. But what gold doesn't do well is it doesn't correlate to that 2%, 3% inflation that's ongoing. That's the basic inflation rate over the last 30 years. And really, if you take out the 70s over the last 50, 60, 70 years, that's a core inflation. And it's a gnawing thing that slowly but surely eats at your buying power. And gold doesn't correlate well with that. When things get nasty and inflation goes to 7%, investors start buying gold hand over fist and gold correlates closely with inflation. But when it's at 2%, it doesn't necessarily do it.
So when you say 7%, is that year over year sustained? Or what do you mean when you say 7%?
The sustained word is a very important word. No, it's 7% on a spike, which is what we saw, I think, around 1974, 75. You know, it's really spiky. And that sustained thing is a very important thing. Because in one of the CPM group's videos last week, where we were talking about gold and inflation, and I was saying, well, you know, there are these people out there saying, talking about get used to, we are now in an era of 20% inflation. Well, we're not in an era of 20% inflation. Even if you use headline inflation, we've seen 2 months of 5.3%, and 2 months did not make an era. And if you look at it historically, when we have seen high inflation, it hasn't gotten to 20%. And you can go back to 1800 and it hasn't gotten to 20%. And you can go back to 1700 in the United Kingdom and it hasn't gotten to 20%, except a few times it did. Right. But even when it gets to 10% or 7% or 15% or 20% or higher during the Great Depression or World War II, it lasts for a month or two and then it comes down. And that's what I was saying. You know, if you look at the data for the last year, this year, you know, where people have become concerned about inflation, you know, you saw 2-3% month over month inflation early in the year. And then it got up to about 0.9, and now it's back down to 0.4. Now, if you look at it on a year-over-year basis, it was much higher inflation all year long. You know, 4% core, 5% headline inflation. But you have to understand that you're measuring it against 2020, when we had a global economic lockdown and no one was buying anything. So there was very little demand, and prices fell, and inflation was low. If you look at it 2019 to 2021, you're looking at about 2.5% annualized inflation. So you're really not looking at a spike of inflation, you know, but the so many people look at it year over year. So now you're looking at 2020 to 2021 and you're seeing 4 or 5% inflation. A year from now, you're going to be looking at 2021 when we have high prices, and 2022, when things presumably will have normalized some, and you're going to have deflation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because prices will have come down. You already see that, you know, in used autos, which is one of the two big factors rising in the summertime, petroleum-based energy and used autos. Used autos are rising 40% a month in the summer. And now they're like, in August, they were off 1.5%. In September, they were off 0.7%. So the prices are already deflating. Yeah. So a year from now, people will look back at inflation fears the same way they look back at some of the things they bought their spouses for Christmas.
So, Jeff, in your mind, is CPI a good measure of inflation?
It's the one we use. I think it is a good one. It's less volatile than PPI. You know, the Fed uses a different one. But we like the CPI for the same reason why we like certain technical analyses things. We like to keep it simple and stupid. Most people look at the CPI. Mm-hmm. Most people don't look at the labor deflator or other things, you know. And I've seen people who were inflation bugs, you know, mainstream economists, and they were convinced that inflation was going to continue to be a problem in the early 80s. And when inflation came down after Paul Volcker did his magic in 1982, 1983, and inflation came down, they spent so much time saying, you know, there must be something wrong with these inflation indicators. Let's tear them apart and rebuild them. Oh, the CRB cannot be an accurate measure of commodity prices. Let's look at it, you know, and let's add this stuff. And they're trying to justify, they're doing research looking to justify their conclusions, as opposed to doing research looking to see what logical conclusion across the data points are. So we use the CPI. We understand how it's done. We understand all of the techniques that the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses, and we're comfortable with it.
So as you mentioned Paul Volcker doing his magic, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that was raising interest rates to, quote, break the back of inflation, right? So how do you see interest rates progressing here through the end of the year and into next year?
Well, you know, they're 10-year bonds are about 1.56 right now, I think. And we see them being basically between 1.4 and 1.8 between now and the end of the year. We see them rising possibly to around 2% over the course of early 2022 and rising a little bit more. But we don't see them rising much over 2.5% for the foreseeable future. And that's in line with the Fed's dot point plot. You know, what the FOMC members believe. They're looking at 2.5% over the next year or two, and they're looking at 2.5% over the next, what they call the longer term. They don't really define what that means, but beyond 2 years. And we kind of see that. We see the scope for sharply higher interest rates at some point, but we're not, that's not our main scenario at this point.
So how about your outlook for gold and silver over that same time period, Jeff? Because, you know, as the CPM group, you guys put out a lot of research and a lot of you know, data into your analysis here.
Yeah. Our gold and silver views are that the prices are still a little bit vulnerable on the downside in the fourth quarter of this year, but, you know, they're trending higher. We're looking at a modest increase in 2021, the last quarter, and we're looking at modest increases over the course of 2022. That's predicated on our view that the economy in the United States and China will continue to expand, and the economies in Europe and other parts of the world will move from recovery into expansion, that you'll continue to see relatively decent recovery growth rates in the real economy, that inflation remains somewhat under control and the inflation parameters year over year come down, that interest rates don't necessarily rise sharply, and that the world doesn't fall apart on the other side of the equation. So we're looking at a modest economic environment, but those bubbles that we're looking at, you know, or we sometimes call them the storm clouds, and we should maybe change them from bubbles to clouds in our graphics. Those storm clouds are continuing to get darker, and they're continuing to get larger. And right now, we don't have them moving into the more probable in the next 6 months range. But at some point, I think they will. Mm-hmm. And that point probably, in our best guess, comes in the final quarter of 2022 or 2023. So we do see a lot of problems, economic, fiscal, financial, monetary, currency, political issues, domestic and international. And we do see a lot of those problems. And we just don't think they're going to be particularly problematic in 2022. But by late 2022 into 2023, we think they become more problematic, more worrisome to investors. Investors start increasing their gold and silver purchases, and that drives the gold and silver prices higher. And if we're right and we move toward a recession and a financial crisis, in that period of time, 2023, 2025, then you could see substantially higher, you know, record higher gold and silver prices.
So as we talk about these storm clouds possibly gathering, you know, further out there, you recently put out an interesting video showing the behavior of the central banks buying gold. So why are the central banks more price sensitive than the retail investors?
Well, I guess that's a tough question. You know, maybe it's because they're a committee of smart economists. You know, they tend to like to buy low and sell high. And investors tend to not buy when the price is low, but buy when the price is rising. So, you know, a lot of investors will gladly give up the first 10% or 20% of an upward move and buy into a rising price, which then reinforces the upward move in prices. And they feel smart until it stops rising and then it falls back, and they don't sell high and they don't sell into a falling market until the very end. And so then they sell low. And central banks try to avoid that. But, you know, investors have a range of investment horizons from 1 week or 1 day to open-ended. You know, and a lot of investors, like a lot of institutions, will say, what's my projected return over the next 3 to 5 years? If I'm going to make this investment, I am going to probably want to liquidate it within 3 to 5 years. So what's my potential return, my IRR, that I can project over that period of time? Central banks, generally speaking, buy gold as a monetary reserve asset. So they're not looking to sell it. They're saying, we need monetary reserves to support our currency and to protect our currency and our economy in times of global financial unrest. And so therefore, we're going to buy it and we're going to store it. Yeah, in that way, they're sort of like the silver stackers. Silver stackers say, we're not really investing in silver, we're stacking it up. You know, and what the difference is a matter of semantics. Yeah, sure looks like an investment. And I think the IRS would call it an investment too. Central banks are a lot like silver stackers. You know, they're buying gold and they're not buying it with the expectation that they're going to sell it in 3 to 5 years. So they like to buy low. And they've tended historically to buy low. And then you say, okay, define low. And low changes over time. So, yeah, 2000, in 2000, 2001, low was below $320 an ounce. By 2007, it was below $500 an ounce. By 2010, it was below $1,000 an ounce. By 2014, it was below $1,200 an ounce. And what we saw in the period March, April, May of this year was a number of central banks, some of whom had not been previous significant buyers of gold, buying gold between, say, 1740 and 1840. So you had these you had central banks basically saying, we still want to buy low, but our definition of low has risen. Yeah. And it's risen significantly, partly because the gold price spiked up to $2,000 in 2020. And so that tells us that on a rewind, it's probably going to go past 2000 again. So $1,800 actually might look like a good price to buy as a long-term open-ended investment.
I know this might be a difficult question to answer. I know I've gotten it many times, but where do central banks source the gold that they want to buy, Jeff?
Generally speaking, they buy it through the global banking market. So local London. They will buy from each other. That was more the case back in the day when you had European central banks and other central banks that were ready sellers. There aren't a lot of ready sellers right now, but it used to be that you would see a central bank say, I want to sell. And they'd say it to themselves and they'd say it to their friends. And the Bank for International Settlement actually did a lot of work brokering this and saying, okay, well, you want to sell and this central bank wants to buy. So you sell it to us and we'll sell it to them. And that allows you to say, we sold our gold, but we didn't sell it into the market. We sold it to another central bank. But that is something of the past because there are fewer central bank buyers, sellers rather. So nowadays, what you tend to see is that the central banks will buy local London or local New York. And usually they typically like to keep it in London or New York, depending on the bank. I mean, one of the trends that we saw 20 years ago was that Islamic central banks started saying, I really am kind of uncomfortable having my metal in Europe or North America, so I'd rather have it other places. So you started seeing it stored in other places.
So what consideration do you think that there are for countries that aren't buying gold, that don't hold any gold reserves, like Canada, for example? Why would they not hold any gold? Are they not worried about, you know, protecting their currency, or do they not just think that through properly?
No, they think it through properly and they are worried about defending their currency. Let me just sort of add to the previous question's answer, which is a lot of central banks, you know, China, Russia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, they tend to buy from locally refined metal, either mine production or scrap. So almost all of the gold that you saw, like, for example, Uzbekistan, I think in September or August added 1.3 million ounces of gold to its reserves, monetary reserves. That was gold that it sourced from domestic Uzbek production. Going on to Canada, for example, Canada is a country that actually says, yes, we, because we're not part of the European system and because we're not the United States, we do have a lot of currency risk and volatility exposure for our currency. And in that kind of environment, we might need to defend our currency at times. You know, defending currencies by buying your domestic currency is far less common nowadays than it was prior to, say, 1999 or so. But you know, it used to be that one of the things you wanted to have was monetary reserves so that you could buy your currency if it was under downward pressure and you wanted it to not fall further. Canada says we have those exposures, and the best currency to have in that environment is the US dollars. So what you saw back in the 80s and 90s was a lot of central banks saying, well, we've got 90, 95, 98% of our monetary reserves in gold. And if we have monetary reserves that we will use to buy our currency, when we buy our currency in, under pressure, we're buying it with US dollars. So if we had our monetary reserves in US dollars, we can go into our currency market and make those defensive purchases of our currency. If we have 90% of our assets in gold, we have to first sell the gold for US dollars. The gold market is a fraction of the size of the US dollar size, and it's a very transparent market for the core people and opaque for the outside market. The outside people really don't have a good vision of what's going on, but the interior core participants in the gold market see it coming. So if you are a banker and you see a central bank selling its gold for US dollars, you know what's going to happen to the US dollar market and to its currency. So you're giving up a lot of your the opacity that you want to support your currency. So a lot of central banks in the 80s and 90s sold gold to build up their dollar reserves because that's what they might need to defend their currency. And Canada is in that group. It was interesting because in the 90s, before we went into the euro, the Danish central bank was selling gold. And somebody asked the central bank manager, you know, why are you doing that? He said, well, in case we need to defend our currency. And the Bundesbank got really upset with that answer because that implied that the Danish central bank was less than 100% committed to the stability of the euro. You know, it's like, wait a second, you're going into the euro. You're not going to have to defend your currency after a couple more years. For you to suggest that you might want to build up dollar reserves in case you need to defend your currency is almost to imply that you think the euro might not come off. Yeah. So that's one of the nuances that we saw back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a really interesting way to look at and think about it. And it would be interesting to see, let's say, how much US dollar reserves Canada actually holds at this time. Why has Turkey been an interesting case in the last, let's say, 2 years when it comes to buying gold?
Turkey is an interesting case because the central bank has taken a very active approach in mobilizing gold for monetary purposes. Most central banks use gold as a monetary reserve asset, and it's pretty much a sterile asset. It's just sitting there. They used to lease it out, but they don't lease out so much gold anymore for a variety of reasons. But the Reserve Bank of India and the Central Bank of the Republic of Turkey have taken a much more proactive approach. So starting in September or October of 2011, when the European Central Bank crisis was going on and Greece was having a major problem and a lot of gold, dollars, and euros were pouring into Turkey for protection, the Turkish central bank said national banks, nationally chartered banks in Turkey can meet their reserve requirements by with up to 10% of their reserve requirements can be in gold, 10% in dollars, 10% in euros. And then in early 2012, they made it 30% for gold. What they did is they allowed, that freed up Turkish lira to be lent into the market to help protect the Turkish economy from any contagion of the problems that were going on with its major trading partners, the European Union. Then last year, what they did, actually earlier they started it, they have a gold bond program and a gold leasing program. And the gold bond program is an investor in Turkey or a citizen in Turkey says, I need cash. You know, the country's locked down, my job is out, I don't have revenue, I need money to buy food and gasoline or whatever. So I'm going to sell some of my gold. But if I sell my gold today and the price is relatively low and then I'm better off financially and I want to buy my gold back, the price might be higher. But the Turkish Central Bank gives me these gold bonds. I can buy a bond with gold and can cash that bond, have Turkish liras. And when I'm ready, I can redeem that bond and get my gold back at the price I sold it at plus an interest rate, less an interest rate. Right. And then a lease rate worked basically the same way. I can turn in gold, including gold jewelry, and I can borrow money by leasing that gold, in essence, to the central bank. So they're finding ways to, A, mobilize gold for monetary purposes and economic support purposes, to allow the commercial banks within Turkey and the individual investors and citizens in Turkey to mobilize gold and use it in a much more monetary fashion. So it's really intelligent stuff, the kind of stuff that every government should be doing. Mm-hmm.
So in your opinion, Jeff, do you think we're ever going to see El Salvador do something like that with Bitcoin, considering they recently made it another form of currency there?
With Bitcoin? No, I don't think they will. You know, and actually, you know, what I've been told in El Salvador and other Latin countries where you find private individual corporations now paying people in Bitcoins, the immediate thing is those Bitcoins are sold for dollars. So there's this massive thing on payday in El Salvador and other countries for Bitcoins being sold for U.S. dollars. And I think that that speaks volumes to the way individuals in these countries look at the dollar and look at cryptocurrencies.
Interesting. So, Jeff, I want to move on to, you know, correcting another term here or thinking about another term, and that's the commodities super cycle term. So is this just a marketing term? And don't the input costs of, let's say, oil and shipping contribute to higher commodity prices?
Our view is that commodity super cycle is pretty much a marketing term. We look back at what was going on in 2000 to 2010, 11, and we said, you know, we had projected a lot of that in 1999, 2000, 2001. And we said, this is economics 101, supply and demand. And, commodity prices are catching up with other asset prices. In terms of oil and input prices, it's very funny. Oil and other input prices ought to be reflected in higher prices for the commodities that are produced with them. But oftentimes what they are reflected in is reduced profitability for producers. You know, and one of the reasons is that, you know, if you think about copper or lead and zinc or steel or aluminum, think about an industrial commodity. And think about the people who use those industrial commodities either to make things or, let's talk about food with citizens. As the oil price rises, that squeezes disposable income that is otherwise allocated to building, you know, buying raw materials like aluminum to build things or food. So what you often see sometimes is that oil prices will rise and that will put a squeeze on demand, industrial demand and consumption demand and fabrication demand for other commodities. So the commodity price might not rise in line with oil prices, partly because the oil prices are reducing the demand for those commodities because the consumers don't have as much discretionary money to spend on other things. And manufacturers also have to cut back on their manufacturing because the consumers are buying fewer products.
So what would have to be true to see what people call a commodity supercycle to happen, Jeff?
Well, a commodity supercycle is really just a, you know, you could call it a marketing hype, you could call it a fantasy. It's just a rubric, you know. what we were saying back in 2000 was that we were looking at a renaissance in gold and a renaissance in commodities. Yeah. And again, I guess maybe that's just marketing hype. But what we were saying, like in the case of gold, was that we expected there to be an upward shift in the investment demand curve, because it's really investment demand that drives the gold price. And we said at that time, November 2000, when we issued a gold buy recommendation, we thought silver would follow with a lag. And it did around 2005, 2006, it started rising. But what we saw was that more investors would be buying more gold for a longer period of time at higher prices in more parts of the world. And that's exactly what happened. And then with general more industrial commodities that are more dependent on fabrication demand, we were looking at the global economy. And you had seen this enormous process really started in the 1970s in a very slow way of globalization, computerization, higher productivity, deregulation. And you saw it start to emerge in China in the late 70s, early 80s, and it accelerated there. You saw it emerge in the 1980s in what they called the Asian Tigers at the time, and in India. And you saw deregulation and globalization and computerization and increase in productivity. You had billions of people who had been restrained by economic and political constraints, let out of their cages. Then you had the collapse of the Soviet Union, the freeing up of Central Europe. You had this enormous increase of people who became free to be their own economic agents. And that led to a surge in demand for everything, from bananas to gold. And that led to this period of prices rising sharply. It took a long lead, but by 2000 or so, that was in place. If you go forward and say, what would it take to happen again? You have to back off from a lot of the political trends now in place in the United States, China, the UK, Europe, and Russia governments. What we have is an anti-globalization, anti-cooperation. You know, trade, international trade is one of the biggest factors in economic growth and the improvement of people's living standards. And we now have governments around the world that are anti-trade. They may not say they're anti-trade, but their actions say they are anti-trade. And what you need to do is back away from that. So the United States needs to, the United States lost the war on terrorism. Now they have to find a new boogeyman in order to justify their defense budget. So you know what? It's China. And you see all kinds of stuff. I mean, China's got its own issues and problems, and I'm not an apologist for China. But you look at the United States, and you watch the news last night, and you've got these apologists for an anti-China bias. Yeah, the American Enterprise Institute, the Hoover Institute at Stanford. These guys are like hawks that wanted to bomb China in the 1950s before they got a nuclear bomb because they were communists, you know. And that there's a resurgence of that. And you've got to back away from that. If the U.S. and other countries, if the governments would back away from their anti-trade, anti-globalization policies and re-engage with each other, then you could see that next leg of the super cycle.
Excellent. Jeff, you mentioned copper in there, and we've seen the spread for spot over futures spike recently. So do you think this is cause for concern? And do you think that this copper shortage is being overblown at this point?
I haven't followed it on a real short-term basis. I do think that there is some excessive bullishness or irrational exuberance in the copper market. I've been looking at it more on a longer term basis. And, you know, people say, well, there's no copper mines to develop. Well, there are. There's a lot of copper reserves and resources that can be developed and will be developed to meet future demand. The other thing is, I think that there is an overblown expectation of how much copper will be needed with the electrification of the world and how fast that electrification will happen. I think the electrification is going to run into a lot of infrastructural impediments and headwinds. And the demand for copper is going to grow much more slowly than some of the copper bulls say. So from a longer term perspective, I think that the copper price is overheated. From a short term perspective, I'm not exactly sure why the copper price has risen so sharply over the last few months, but it's probably is overblown at this point simply because it's risen so far so fast. You would expect that you're going to see some sort of pullback.
And as you mentioned, the electrification of the world, and you know, basically having all these metals available to meet this demand, how do you see the supply of the electric metals, for example, like the battery metals, further out to be able to meet that demand, and even silver to some extent to meet the demand that is coming for this electrification?
Yeah, that's one of the infrastructural impediments to a rapid movement to electric vehicles that I was referring to. You know, actually, a lot of the metals are there and you can meet it. You know, there is some, the two metals that stand out, one is lithium, and the other one is manganese sulfate, specifically high purity manganese sulfate. Manganese is an enormous market. Almost all the manganese is used in ferro alloys, manganese and direct use of manganese ore. But high purity manganese sulfate, the capacity is not there. And you know, there's this almost Pollyanna-esque view that don't worry, it'll be built. But you look at one of the other impediments, which is capital availability for the OEM component manufacturers. Yeah, the automakers don't make most of their parts. They buy them, and they buy them from smaller public companies or oftentimes privately owned companies. Auto companies can borrow as much money as they want at, you know, 50 bips over LIBOR, you know, but these smaller companies can't borrow money at any rate. And if they do, it's like 12%. So there's this capital formation issue, which is, okay, you right now, this year, we're using about not quite 6 million motors. Last year and the year before, it was 2 million motors in electric vehicles. And you want to go to 52 million vehicles in 30 years. And you want to go to 35 million vehicles in 10 years. So you need to build motor factories to make 35 million motors, not 5 million. And we're not going to give you offtake agreements. We're not going to give you orders because, quite frankly, we're not sure that we're going to meet that need, because we may not be building, you know, we're telling the public and we're telling government leaders, yeah, we can go to 35 million vehicles in 9 years. But the reality is we might be able to go to 8 million vehicles in 9 years. And so we're not going to give you offtake agreements. We're not going to give you financial support of any kind. And quite frankly, the technology is so uncertain and it's changing so rapidly. In 10 years, we may be moving to hydrogen engines and electric vehicles may be a thing of the past. So there's this starvation of the capital needed to build not only the lithium mines and the high purity manganese sulfate factories, but everything else, including cobalt sulfate and nickel sulfate and the lithium batteries and the graphite. You know, so there's and then you get into the components, yeah, the doorknobs, yeah, the motors, the controllers, everything that's required for an electric vehicle. And to build them not at the rate of 6 million a year, but 30 or 40 or 50 million a year. It's just not there. It's going to take a lot longer, you know. And the private sector is not providing the financing. You're seeing greater growth in China because they have a managed economy and the government says, we're sitting on $3.2 trillion in the People's Bank. We're sitting on a few trillion dollars more in the China Investment Corp. China Investment Corp will invest in these companies and put in the capital needed because the government says we want to move to electric vehicles. So half the electric vehicles being bought this year and last year are in China because the government wants it. The other half are being bought primarily in Europe by people who are worried about the climate change. And then when they realize that the amount of carbon dioxide kicked out by lithium mining, lithium ion battery manufacturing, burning coal and petroleum and natural gas to generate the electricity is as great as the carbon dioxide put out by burning petroleum in a car engine, you could see a consumer backlash. Similar to what you saw with diesel fuel in Europe when they realized that diesel fuel, in fact, was not cleaner than petrol. So there are a lot of issues that could really cause headwinds. But you're right. One of them is there's not enough metal around, and there have to be these mines built, and there has to be greater recycling of copper from scrap. There's an enormous amount of copper scrap out there that's just sitting in scrapyards. And so there's a lot to be done to get to that brighter future.
So as we think about those different push-pull demands, are we going to see a possible backlash with the green energy generation as we're seeing, you know, for example, England right now not having the energy it needs going into the winter, not having the natural gas reserves it needs?
Yeah, well, that's one of the problems. I mean, most countries don't have enough electricity generating capacity to meet current and prospective household and industrial requirements, let alone to have extra electricity to power vehicles. So there's got to be a gigantic growth in electricity generating capacity. And if you look at like the International Energy Agency's projections, you go out to 2040, you go out to 2050, and petroleum is still the major source of energy for the world. And natural gas is up there. Coal is up there tied with all other renewables combined. You know, so you're looking at a world that realistically 30 years from now is still going to be using three times the hydrocarbons that it uses for renewables. Yeah. And then you have the people saying, wait a second, buying an electric vehicle doesn't necessarily help climate change. It might help clean up the pollution in the cities, but it's simply moving the exhaust to where the power is being generated. So, there are a lot of issues that could come in and put spanners in the works. Mm-hmm.
Moving it further upstream.
Yes.
Jeff, do you pay attention to any of the, you know, the idea that we've reached peak oil?
I pay attention to it and I write it off. Yeah, peak oil, this theory has been around since at least 1970. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like, oh, the treasury is going to collapse. And it was very funny because I was at a luncheon yesterday and I made fun of somebody who's been saying since 1981 that the treasury is going to collapse. And they said, okay, so he's not right yet. He will be sometime. And I said, maybe he will, maybe he won't. And, you know, after 40 years, you got to sort of say, hey, maybe there's something fundamentally wrong with your analysis. So you look at peak oil, and these guys have been around since 1970 at least, and they've been wrong for 50 years. At what point do you say, I'm going to go across the street to that other church because their faith seems to be based on something more credible than yours? Mm-hmm. You know? So you look at peak oil, you look at oil, the realities of the petroleum industry and the petroleum market. It doesn't look like peak oil in terms of supply of oil is going to be there. There will be a peak in oil production at some point in the distant future, and it'll be because of lower demand for oil, not because we're running out of oil.
Excellent, Jeff. Well, I appreciate getting to go over all these topics with you. Do you have anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up here?
I think that's probably pretty much the same. I mean, you know, just if you put it all together, I think what I'm saying is there's a tremendous amount of short-term and long-term uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And most of the uncertainty is a little longer term. In our view, it's beyond 2022. And we might have a little bit of a breather here for the next five quarters, which might be a good period of time for people to educate themselves on the realities of the commodity markets and start to build up positions that would bear fruit 2 to 10 years from now. Mm-hmm.
Excellent, Jeff. Of course, all of your research is available at cpmgroup.com, and you post links to your videos at CPM Group LLC on Twitter. Anywhere else you'd like to point to?
That's about it. People can send us emails at info@cpmgroup.com asking about specific issues like, you know, hey, what kind of research should I buy or what kind of consulting services might I benefit from?
Excellent. Perfect, Jeff. Thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure. It's good to see you again.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.